Okay, we are now recording. So welcome all. I'll just stop my deck, stop my share. Welcome all to the July 15th Q&A. Just a reminder that we are recording the session audio only. So if you don't want your voice to be part of the record, if you do have to ask anything, you could use the chat window, although the chat window will also be part of the record. So I guess we'll go ahead and get started, and I'll ask Alan to lead off with the deck.
So you can see my title slide?
Yes, I can.
Okay, very good. All right, so the first thing we have on the agenda is a follow-up from last week's session. And if you remember, we were talking about how to find image files and how to find them and then back them up. One of the suggestions was to use Xcopy or Robocopy. And so I had a little look at Xcopy because that's built into Windows. You don't need to do anything other than use it. And it turns out it's a really very useful, very powerful command. And if I wanted to copy all of the JPEG files from, let's say, my temporary folder here, from one drive to another, so let's say I've got an external drive plugged into drive G, and drive E is my data partition, and I'm using Xcopy with a slash S and slash Y switch to copy all the JPEG files, star.jpg, from one folder to the other. And the two switches are slash S is a recursive switch, so it basically goes through all of the folders and subfolders of the drive that I'm pointing at and copies them over, unless they're empty. And if they're empty, I don't want them anyway, so that's fine. And the slash Y is a yes feed. So basically it says if Xcopy tries to write the same file to the same location, don't bother to prompt me if I want to overwrite the file. And it's probably not very necessary. It's unlikely people would have the same JPEGs in more than one place and be copying them to the same place. But it's a useful switch anyway. And then I thought, well, you'd have to do that for JPEGs and PNGs and GIFs and MP4s and all kinds of things. So how would you copy all of the image file types? And it turns out our for command turns out to be really useful in that respect. So we use this for in deuce type scenario, and we say for %e, the extension, in, and then we give it a list of extensions, and I just give it two for brevity. So if a file has an extension of JPEG or GIF, then do something, and the do something is do the X copy. So basically I could point that, say, at the C drive and copy everything, all the image files from the C drive to the G drive. And I just caution you that it's a very useful command, it's a very powerful command, but it's also a very space intensive command. And you really don't know that if you just use the copy command, you really don't know what you're copying. So you better make sure that you have an awful lot of space available on the target drive. So, you know, like a 1 terabyte external USB drive would probably take care of all eventualities. Now, personally, I think I'd look at a way of identifying where the JPEG files are before I actually copy them. And I pointed out you could do that with that everything search program. There's also ways to do it using the dir command, for example, in a command window. But anyway, that's a really easy way to copy all of the files on one drive and back them up to another drive. So whoever, I think it was Tom Chottier suggested that. So that was a really useful tip. Okay, moving along, Chris has some more thoughts on Internet Explorer.
Yeah, So there was a little bit of contention on whether anybody should be using IE anymore. And my thoughts on it were that, first off, I wasn't suggesting that IE is the best browser or even a good browser nowadays. But it is supported from Microsoft. And so from a vulnerability point of view, which I think is what's really important, to stop using something that is not supported by the vendor, doesn't bear up with IE. So if you like IE for whatever reason, you don't have to worry about continuing to use it from a security point of view. You probably still have to worry about using it from a usability point of view. So I have there a link to the Microsoft article that talks about the fact that it is a component of Windows. It follows the lifecycle policy of the product on which it's installed. And there is a statement, only the most current version of IE receives technical support and security updates. There's no reason not to be on the most recent version of IE for sure. And the next slide. So Internet Explorer 11 is going to be the last major version of the browser. And it is interesting to say that Microsoft itself says we're not supporting new web standards for it. Many sites will work fine, but developers by and large aren't testing anymore with IE. And so you're going to be running into more and more websites that just don't render properly if you're using IE. But again, from a security point of view, it is supported. And anybody who says that it shouldn't be used from a security point of view, I would really like evidence of any security problem that Microsoft has said they will not fix in Internet Explorer, because I've seen no evidence of that whatsoever.
I disagree. I did provide a link, and with all due consideration, I believe you're swimming against the current on this one.
You have evidence of security issues that Microsoft says they won't fix?
I put it in the link in the last meeting.
Okay, because I had not seen anything from that, and I would certainly take it to Microsoft if I saw that they're, okay. You know, and say, you know, if you're supporting it, why aren't you fixing this?
I think I Googled, and I'll do it again. Why shouldn't I run Internet Explorer?
And the answer comes back, because it's Microsoft.
No.
Well, I can look it up in last week's chat. And yes, certainly if okay. there...
I got it. I found it right here. Unfortunately, the links are still there, and I'll repost it. And anyways, yeah. I mean, this was from... I'm going to look at it, the article... Come on, give me a date. Okay, well, this one's from last year, but I believe in the last 2 years. Anyways, the consensus, I was under the impression that I was reading up to your thoughts on it, was that Internet Explorer should only be used when you absolutely need to use it for internal resources and there's no alternative offered. Otherwise, don't use it. Yes, it is updated because it is an integral part of the operating system, which one could argue is not a good thing to have. But that's to Alan's point, that's Microsoft. And anyways, hey, that's my opinion.
Yep, okay.
The guy that wrote that must have about the same opinion as me of Microsoft. Okay, moving on to another Microsoft product. We had a lot of discussion about BitLocker, and Pete Roberts has some more thoughts on BitLocker.
Oh, but I can't really put them on the air, actually, but you just feel it lifted a stone and wish you hadn't. But what it was, you know, it came out from Lawrence, actually. No, it's a home edition. Why have you got BitLocker? And a little bit of searching around, and certainly in some Hewlett-Packard machines, if you have modern standby, you almost certainly got BitLocker installed and activated. And in my case, no ability to make it go away or, you know, disable it or suspend it while I'm doing things. When I go, Chris gave a good hint last week to do a search in Control Panel, never really thought about doing that before, actually. And then I found something called device encryption. So, Eureka, I go in, I get lots of stuff on how now I can back up my recovery key, and I've now done it to a USB as well. But I'm missing the options. And by Googling around, other people thought, oh, this is how you do it. You just go into the encryption key or device encryption, and there you are. I don't have that. So that's where I am at the moment. So if I'd go into safe mode, I presume I still have to enter a 48-digit code to get in. The aside to this is that, when I did the partition, and it reminded me on the screen there, Alan, my departition has got BitLocker as well. It doesn't seem to be getting in the way at the moment. Very strange. I want to alter the partition size. I'm just wondering what's going to happen when I try to do that. Anyway, so, if you go, it sort of pointed to going into a command prompt with admin, and it power, Charlie Foxtrot Golf /A. And on my machine, it comes up, the following sleep states are available on this system. Standby S0, low power idle, network connected, hibernate, and fast startup. And previous listeners will realize that's where he started on this, because fast startup was giving me black screens when I was coming out of sleep. And so far, it's been all right. Now I've got rid of it. And then it lists the whole of the ones I don't have as well. But, so that is, you can have BitLocker, but I am quite concerned now that I don't have the full, so it's a crippled version of the thing.
So you haven't found any way to disable it then?
There's two things. One, I've put a little side on this. Think it can get into the BIOS to do it, but the real worrying thing, and I think I'm going to have to talk to someone at Hewlett-Packard, because one HP owner was saying, before I can update my BIOS, HP says I've got to deactivate BitLocker. So if ever I get that message, I've got a problem.
But, sorry, do you say you get that message or you don't get that message?
If I ever get that message, I've got a problem, because disable BitLocker to update the BIOS. I've never had the message from Hewlett-Packard to say I had to do it. In fact, I did a BIOS update only about a week ago, actually, with great trepidation. So I've seen something in the processes window about BitLocker, and I have thought, can I get in there and tell it to go away or disable it or something, but I haven't tried that. I wasn't in as admin anyway, so you've got to go off to the rigmarole of coming back as administrator. So that's it. I'm still sort of sorting around on this to say, well, either give it me or don't give it me. but as I say, the window at device encryption looks identical to the one that's coming up on the various answers to the problem, but I don't have the options list.
It seems that that's an issue with your HP machine. The black bar on the bottom there says that this SO low power idle does not support this standby mode, this system. That's my Dell laptop. And so it doesn't have that option. And if I put BitLocker into the search bar, it doesn't find it on the machine. So my home version of Windows 10, whatever it is, doesn't have BitLocker installed.
Oh, I think it's
supposed to be an HP feature.
Well, yeah, feature. The lower price point unit doesn't have it. It does not have this S0 low power business, modern standby, and it doesn't have BitLocker. There's a moral there. Buy the cheaper machine, it's simpler. Right? So that's it. I'm not trunching about this little problem, but
okay, thank you.
No, it's an interesting one for sure. I gather that HP put it in as a
face complete.
I guess it's their way of saying, hey, even though you're buying a home machine, we're providing you BitLocker. Aren't you happy now?
Lucky you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I'd just like to touch on power toys for a second. If you remember last week, Chris was giving a demo of Fancy Zones, the kind of Windows snap feature. And I'd mentioned that in the past I'd used the Image Resizer app. And Chris said that when you download and install PowerToys, you don't just get Fancy Zones, you get everything. So I downloaded it, and sure enough, there is Image Resizer. And when you run Image Resizer, you get a number of image sizes by default. So you see there you've got like small, medium, and large, and phone. But you can also hit that plus key and get an empty box and create a custom size. So rather than use their medium 1366 by 768, I set a custom size of 1024 by 768 because that's the same aspect ratio as the pictures that come off my camera. So it doesn't alter the aspect ratio. And I also use another one, sometimes a 640 by 480 for posting pictures to the web. I find they're big enough to see, but they're small enough so that the pages load really fast. Anyway, let's look at this 1024 by 768. So here are three pictures taken on one of my cameras. And you can see, well, maybe you can't see, but they're basically 3,000 by 4,000 pixels. So they're quite big. And down the bottom here, this one is 1.8 megabytes. So if I wanted to send that to somebody by email, I wouldn't be able to send very many of them at once, probably. So what I can do is I can go into Windows Explorer, and when you install PowerToys, it basically hooks the resized pictures into the context menu. So if I highlight the pictures in my folder and hit the right click, I bring up this context menu, and you can see I've got this option for resize the pictures. So if I hit that, select that, then it pops up the image resizer box. It chooses custom by default, and it also has checked ignore the orientation of the pictures, which is a really nice feature because that means that it doesn't matter whether the size is landscape or portrait, it will resize them appropriately. And some resizing options don't do that, so this is a really nice feature. It has another useful box there, which I've left unchecked just for the purposes of demonstration. Resize the original pictures, or in this case, don't resize the original pictures. So in this case, it's actually going to create copies so that we can see what it does. And the other option is to make the pictures smaller but not larger. And I'm not sure why you would want to resize pictures to be larger, but I would never actually use that.
Well, I could see that happening if you had selected a whole bunch of photos and one of them happened to be very small already and you end up resizing it larger.
Right. Yes. Okay. So by just selecting that, then you can see now we've got twice as many pictures. And if I go back to my image viewer, you can see that the pictures look, they kind of look as though they're doubled up. But remember, I've just resized them and I retain the originals. So I've actually got originals plus the copies. And if I just pull up one pair of pictures, you can see that the one on the right, the original, is the 3,000 by 4,000 with 1.8 meg. And I've resized it to 768 by 1024. And that's dropped the image size down to 76 kilobytes, which is a huge reduction. So now I can send somebody 10 pictures or 20 pictures, no problem. Or I'd have my 640 by 480s ready for posting to the website. So it's a very powerful, very simple way of resizing a whole bunch of pictures at once. So if anybody needs that kind of capability, I highly recommend resize pictures.
Ellen, there's one thing in there that Image Resizer doesn't give you. With JPEG, you have not only pure resolution, but you also have a compression factor. And Image Resizer doesn't allow you to adjust compression on the photo. And so sometimes I find that one or the other or a combination of both is actually optimal for what I want. So this is really good for what it does. But just keep in mind that there are other ways of doing resizing, which also allows you to adjust the compression factor on the photo.
Yeah, and actually this is a program called Fastone Image Viewer. And somewhere over here it has tools. And if you hit tools, it's got options to do batch conversion and batch renaming. And it has enough features to let you choose compression ratios and stuff.
Yeah.
So again, that's a really nice tool for, and it's also a really neat way to look at pictures. Okay, moving on. One of the participants tonight is my brother-in-law in London, Ontario, fine gentleman, and this time he's opted to share with us a program which he uses. He actually found some homemade movies, which were on DVD, and his concern was that, well, is he always going to have a DVD player to play them? But he could also convert the video to a different format, say MP4, which is very much in use these days. And he found this program from France, an open source program called Handbrake. And Handbrake is essentially a video conversion utility. So when you load Handbrake, it asks you what you want to do, and we want to load a file. So we browse to the file we want and load it in, and then we've got all these different tabs. We only need to do a couple of things. On the video tab, we're going to choose down here on the right-hand side, we can browse, and we can choose a subdirectory and give it a file name that we want to use. And then the other thing he found that was very useful was this thing here called constant frame rate. So by default, you get peak frame rate. He found it best if you switch that and use a constant frame rate. And then finally, going back to the summary tab, one of the other neat things it does is that if the audio and the video aren't in synchronization, this thing has a little checkbox there which says align the start of the audio and the video tracks. And that apparently gets rid of that dilemma. So once you've set a couple of options like that, all you have to do is hit this magic button up here called Start Encode, sit back, and depending on the length of your video file, it takes a little while to do the transformation, but then you will end up with your and output MP4 file in the folder that you asked for. And so if you have any video files that you want to convert to different formats, this is quite an easy way to do it. And it's a completely free and open source program, of course. We like free.
I highly recommend it.
You've used it, Lawrence?
I use it fairly consistently and not enough that I understand the settings, but I personally, because I don't know, though I'm going to have to look at some of the things that you circle, after trying a couple of things and reading up on it and figuring out that, no, I just wanted a simple do this, if you go to the presets and select that, that will take care of most of the settings and do the job. And there's a whole bunch. It's based on, you can have it based on web, device. There's, I would guess about 40 different selections that, you know, if you look at it, you say, oh yes, that's what I want. And you check it and off you go.
So you basically preset the output criteria and then you just load the file and encode it.
Yes. Yeah, because it fills in the rest of this, I understand.
So it's really simple to use.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, neat program. Okay, moving on. A computer that started off life as Windows 7 and got upgraded to 10 and has been subject to system resets and upgrades and tweaks and all kinds of wonderful things. And the individual has lost track of what's been done and to which machine, because you've got multiple machines in the same boat. So that one of the problems is trying to keep track of changes to the machine. And the other thing is, what do all these things do? And if you're tweaking things, how do they survive all these resets and Windows updates and feature updates and that kind of thing? So I just chip in here with my technique for figuring out what's going on. And what I do is I keep a document, and I just log all the changes to the system. So that includes updates to the operating system, when I install new programs, when I update installed programs. And I also keep records of when I make a backup disk image, because I tend to make full disk images of my system, usually on a monthly basis. And I find this document file really useful, because if I hit a problem, I can just look back and I can see, well, when did I make the last image? And what have I done to the system since then? So I can repeat the good things and hopefully avoid the bad things. And talking about tweaking things, you find these neat little tweaks and commands, and then you do it, and then you forget about it. And then later on, 2 years later, you want to do the same thing to a different machine. Well, I can go back to my log and search for some obscure phrase or something. And generally, I can find the command that I used to do something. So that's I find that a really useful thing to do. And it's basically a simple text file. I keep it in LibreOffice Writer. And you can see here, this is basically documenting my Linux side of my box. And that's mainly because Windows, in its ultimate wisdom, doesn't like me to cut and paste the changes that were made in the monthly updates and things. So I tend to not bother with what's going on in Windows, but I do document what's going on in Linux. So you can see right here in early June, the 2nd of June, I made a full disk image highlighted in yellow here. And then I've done a bunch of updates, including updating Vivaldi and Windows there, which is not part of the Windows update, which is why I've got it there. And then on the 9th of July, a few days ago, I was getting a message that I should upgrade to Mint version 20. So I followed the recommended path of trying to upgrade on the fly, as it were. But it was running a script, and the script seemed as though it was taking forever. And as I watched what it was doing, it seemed to be going over the same ground over and over and over again. So I think it was basically stuck in a loop. So my solution is just to bail out of it and then go back into my disk imager and restore, but just the Linux partition. So I take the Linux partition off this disk image and restore that back to my drive. And then I basically, because all I've really done is on the Linux side of the box, is just on regular updates, I haven't done anything else, I can just do one upgrade to the update manager, which was pending, and then by default it will automatically load all of the updates that I need, so I didn't have to do anything special in this case. But you can see the beauty of the system. If you do have problems, I can see what I've done as I've been going along. I think Chris has some other thoughts on actual tweaks.
Yeah, I think the idea is that it depends on the tweak that you're actually doing, and there's going to be no way of knowing what changes you make to the operating system are actually going to survive any particular update or upgrade or anything like that. I think, and this is my personal opinion, Microsoft has not promised it, any tweak that is just personalization and has no effect on the underlying operating system itself, I think should survive any upgrade or update to the operating system. Again, that's my thoughts, not Microsoft necessarily. And then there's the question, what if something is related to changes in the underlying operating system? Almost certainly, Microsoft is going to undo some tweak that you've done if it means that some change to the operating system is going to be in conflict with that. They're going to win that battle, not you. And I would say it's doubly likely that they're not going to survive if you are not using standard Windows tools, like going into settings and making a change there to colors or any kind of personalization or settings there. If you're going in and you've got a registry edit that was recommended to you, that may or may not be supported in some future version of the operating system, so it may or may not survive. Now, going to the next slide, all of that stuff was saying that, yeah, it should survive if it's just personalizations. Microsoft, there is lots of evidence of them just deciding on a whim that they are going to make a change to your experience in Windows and not even tell you that they're doing it, and they're doing it obviously not for your best interest. The biggest one that I can think of is that every time you get a major update to Windows, you are going to find that the default browser is set to Microsoft Edge, regardless of what you had selected. So that to me is evidence that Microsoft will step over your toes whenever they see fit to do so. Hopefully, they are not doing it very often, but you can't tell. So if you have an operating system that was upgraded from Windows 7, potentially through 8 and into 10, and then through major feature releases, there could be lots and lots of changes that are going to get undone by Microsoft in the background, and you're probably not going to be told about it any of those times that it happens. So in that case, I think Alan's idea of logging every change that you make is probably a really good idea. And if you notice that something isn't working the way it was, you can go back and you can say, oh, that seems to have been undone, and try redoing it again on your own.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. One thing I find is on major updates, Microsoft used to reset all your default applications back to their defaults, and you had to go back and change all your file associations. At least the last couple of updates have been more polite, and so when you click on a particular file that requires a particular application, it comes up now and says, do you want to continue using whatever it was you were using, or would you rather use this?
That is more polite. Still not, I think it's still far from ideal, but they should just leave that alone. But, that's certainly an improvement.
Yeah. Another thing I find it uninstalls is a lot of people were dissatisfied when they upgraded from Windows 7 to Windows 8 or Windows 10, and they found out that the Microsoft games like Solitaire and FreeCell and Minesweeper, that the new versions really sucked, and they wish the old versions were there. So one particular person went and packaged up all of the Windows 7 games and everything into a package you could install on Windows 10. And I went and did that, and whenever there's a major upgrade, Microsoft uninstalls it.
Yeah, I've got an upcoming quick tip for the newsletter. It'll be coming up sometime, I guess, late fall probably now, on how if you still have your old, I think, Windows XP CD, you can extract out the pinball game and install it onto – it doesn't even really require an install. You can just set it up on Windows 10, and it runs quite well.
Does it run legally?
Well, if you own the XP CD, I don't see how it's not.
You are running on a Microsoft platform, so that sounds quite reasonable to me.
Yeah.
I've seen evidence of both what Chris has said and what Bob has said. The funny thing is that it's a bit of a crapshoot as to which machines will exhibit which behavior. And to my recollection, all the machines are put together the same way. So I think it has something to do with how, in this case, Dell prepackages the operating system on their machine before I get it. But that's just a hunch.
There could be randomness to the way Microsoft is doing things as well. I know in their Insider program, they do a lot of A-B testing where half the people will get an upgrade in the Insider program that has different features than the other half of the people. So whether they're doing the same thing on releases, I don't know. I don't really trust them all that much.
We love to hate them.
Okay, well, moving on again to another Microsoft question. Integrating Skype into Windows and finding two Skype shortcuts in the start menu. The question is there any reason to keep a standalone installation of Skype if Microsoft's always going to keep upgrading it or forcing it on you? I don't use Skype, and I never really notice it, so I don't know whether anybody else has any thoughts on Skype.
Yes, so that's Microsoft has been doing that. They've been doing that with OneNote too. I guess you use the same, or you, well, my recommendation based on what I've seen is the Windows 10 version isn't as good as the standalone version, and you continue to use the standalone version. That said, I thought I read something from a month or so ago that said that Microsoft was finally going to just have the one Skype program going forward. But I'm Googling it right now, and I'm not finding it.
I seem to recall Paul Thurrott mentioning that as well. But, I mean, Microsoft has gone back and forth on Skype so many times. I don't use it, so I don't really follow it to see what is the current state of it. But I have heard that numerous times where it goes back and forth between a Windows Store app to a desktop app and then back. And there doesn't seem to be any consistent, holistic approach by Microsoft when it comes to Skype at all.
It's all about Teams, it seems.
Yeah, it seems that, but I don't know. They haven't said that they're giving up on Skype, so.
It's a funny sort of Skype thing happening on this machine. Lots of things, funny things happen on this machine. Logging on a standard, nothing happens. When I've been going in as administrator, everything's going fine, it works all fine, but I suddenly get this yellow message, unable to find Skype.
Wow.
Yes. Well, it's a long string of saying Windows can't find X, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah.
But everything seems to work. I don't recall getting rid of it in disgust, but, you know.
I just found, it's funny you mentioned that, I just found the article from June 23rd. Microsoft is getting rid of one version of Skype. I'm posting it now. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. PC World is showing is not secure. Disk. Gotta love it when a computer magazine can't get their certificates correct. Mind you, they're not the only professional organization that's flubbed the, keeping their websites up to date or whatever.
Well, we ran into that on opcug.ca where it was actually, the reason why it was being flagged as not secure was that there were some references or some content that was being pulled in. I think it was mostly graphics. From areas of the site, and they were being pulled in using HTTP as opposed to HTTPS, so the browser flagged the whole thing as being insecure. So PC Magazine might have done the same thing, where because I can't imagine they wouldn't, that their certificate would expire, but it's been known to happen. Microsoft had their Microsoft.com certificate expire one time.
Yeah.
Okay, a question came in, and what company does the club use for its June recycling program, the e-waste event? And the answer was that we were using OES, which is the Ontario Electronic Stewardship Organization, but the problem is that the Ministry of Environment, in its wisdom, has decided to wind up that program. And so that is no longer available, so this year we will not have an e-waste event, at our June meeting, like a month ago. We didn't get pizza either, did we? But one of these days. Anyway, some people have, Chris has one thought, and then we'll turn it over to Bob Walker, who has some other considerations.
Yeah, I know this one in particular is on Bob's list as well. I did a little bit of a look around because I know Best Buy was one of the locations where you go to any Best Buy and just drop off stuff. And then I thought because of COVID-19 they had stopped it or put a halt on it. But according to their website, it's up and running now, so you can still do it. But I'll defer to Bob Walker, who did a bunch more investigation into this. So, Bob, if you wanted to take over and show something or...
Okay, yeah, I'll, here we go.
You got your own slides, Bob?
Yeah, I did a quick slide here, so.
Okay, well, let me just stop and you can take over.
Let me just. Okay, there's a couple websites you can go to get a whole list of different places you can go. One is recyclemyelectronics.ca. This covers all of Canada, so you choose your province, and then you go through the, and it'll give you all sorts of stuff. The other is the ontarioelectronicstewardship.ca, which is Ontario only. And as you say, the stewardship program per se has been dropped, but the website still gives you a lot of places you can go. One of the big places that they'll list of places is what they call the Take It Back retailers. And these include Staples, and Staples also takes ink cartridges and old batteries. Best Buy also takes batteries besides electronics. Some of them might take ink cartridges. And there's also Habitat for Humanity, the Habitat for Humanity Restores. However, because most of these lists are pre-COVID, so you need to check with the individual business or site. And literally, yeah, you know, the Staples, for example, in Kempville, which is close to me, still isn't open for recycling yet. But some of the other Staples in Ottawa are. And the same goes for Best Buy and Habitat for Humanity. So you really got to check with the individual business to see if they're still open for this. The one place I am sure of is the Trail Road dump site. The City of Ottawa Trail Road dump site on Moody Drive will take electronic recycling for free. They'll also take tires and metal recycling for free. So you don't have to pay anything to get rid of it. If you're taking actual waste and scrap there, you have to pay by weight. The slide here gives the hours are open. You can also find this information at ottawa.ca/en/garbage-and-recycling, and it's up there. And so you can get rid of your stuff there. Now, this also goes for a lot of the surrounding municipalities around Ottawa on the Ontario side. They have places, and if you go to the Ontario Stewardship thing website, you can... get that information, and they have their dump sites or another municipal site where you can drop off your electronic recycling. So there's a number of possibilities in the areas surrounding Ottawa. Now, the City of Ottawa used to accept e-waste during their household hazardous waste events, but this year because of COVID. Number one, they've only had one household hazardous waste event, and because of the COVID procedures and rules, they no longer accept electronic waste, and they have a few other limitations from what they previously used to do. They haven't listed any new hazardous waste events on our website as of yesterday. I know they're planning to do so, but they haven't opened them up yet. Previously, the hazardous waste events were a one-day thing, and whatever, but there's always a huge lineup of cars looking to get in. So the one that they have had this year was actually over 6 days. He revised that if you're in line at 4 o'clock when they closed, too bad, so sad, come back next day. So your best bet is right now is to check with the Best Buy or the Staples closest to you, see if they're accepting the stuff. Otherwise, you may want to take it to one of the municipal drop-off sites.
Yeah, there's a posting in the chat, Bob, from Natalie saying that at the moment Staples isn't accepting anything, but Home Depot is accepting batteries.
Okay. Yeah, I think Lowe's is also accepting batteries. And again, it depends on the individual store.
Yeah, it changes from day to day anyway, it seems to anyway, but it does relate to individual stores, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so with that, we're at the stage. Anybody else have any questions, comments, things that they'd like to share, warnings they'd like to give? Unmute your microphone if you wish to speak.
I don't know if this is going to be kind of a dumb question for you guys, but...
You like dumb questions.
Okay, that'll be me. So I was looking through the list of that DPC watchdog violation blue screen thing, potential fixes, and one of the suggestions was to use the Windows command prompts and go in for check, check disks.
Right. But
I can't get in as the administrator. It won't let me in. It says that I'm the user. So I'm a little confused. I put, like, when I have my screen, when I go into my computer, I use my password that was used, and I didn't realize that there was a difference for me. I'm the only user. I don't remember setting this up as anything different.
Okay, so if you type in CMD in the search box of Windows,
yeah,
then it will say, it says command prompt. If you right-click on that, and you should be able to choose run as administrator.
I didn't have that option.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe I don't know.
The other thing to do, have you got the screen, Chris?
So does it make a difference? I'm in 8.1.
Sorry, I didn't unmute myself. What I'm sharing right now is if you go into settings and you go into accounts, mm-hmm. You should be able to see all of your different, but you're in 8.1, you say?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure how they've changed the
account. It must be similar, Chris.
Well, I'm not sure because the account settings came from out of Control Panel, and I think it was Windows 10 before they really integrated it all properly into settings. It might be there, but it might not, or it might actually take you to Control Panel to actually do anything of consequence. But what you end up seeing somewhere, you should be able to see all of the accounts that are on your computer. So you can see here I have Quirky, a local account, and I have Chris Taylor as an administrator. The local account here is not an administrator. Okay, so it's a regular user account. Now this is something really bad. Actually, I'm not even sure if that might actually be an administrator account. But you should always have multiple administrator accounts on your computer, at least two. And that way you can always log in as one of the administrators to fix any problems, including things like running check disk on the system drive.
When I went into my version of this, I only saw one. That was the one that it's not letting me do anything on. It was really weird. It's kind of like there's like it's missing. Does it always, like, how is the admin account set up?
It's when you first install Windows or first configure it, if it's pre-installed on your computer, it should come up and ask you for an account to create, and it will normally create an administrator account. And then later on, you can go in, you can manually create additional accounts if you so desire. And as I say, you should always have at least two accounts on there that are administrator level, just so that if something in the profile gets corrupted and is refusing to let you log on, you have another account that you can get in to fix things. Wherever you are in Windows 8, it should actually be able to tell you whether it's an administrator account or a regular standard user account. Does it?
Oh, okay, so I'll try those two things again, and let's see.
Are you using settings or control panel?
I've done both.
Let me just look in control panel, because I'm pretty sure that they stripped it out of control panel now. User accounts is there, even in Windows 10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it looks like you can do it even in Windows. So in Windows 8, I would go to control panel and then user accounts.
Okay. Okay. So it was weird that I couldn't right-click in the command prompt box. It just wouldn't give me that option.
Yeah, that is weird, because in Google, that's telling you, they tell you exactly that, right-click on the command prompt and run as administrator. So
And even if your account is an administrator, then it will prompt you for account credentials that would be an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
It might also say run as another user or something like that in prior versions of Windows. But if in control panel user accounts, you should see a list of, there should be a link to say manage another account, and then it will actually come up with a list of all of the accounts that are on your computer.
Okay.
I'm just posting a link right now in the chat, which seems to give a fairly good overview of updating account settings.
Thank you.
I find where the chat windows disappeared to.
Okay, thanks.
And there it is. Yeah, I just posted it, so give that a try, Natalie, and walk it through type of thing.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, but anybody who doesn't have multiple accounts on their computer, at least two administrator level accounts, I highly recommend that you do create at least two, so you don't accidentally lock yourself out. Make sure you remember what the password is on the accounts.
Okay, any other questions?
Okay, it looks like there's another thing. Actually, there's one there. Eldon. Eldon sent me a message. Is there a way to set the two admin accounts if we're already set up and running? You need to be logged in as an administrator if you want to create a new account, for sure. So I presume that if you're able to install software and things like that, your regular account that you're using is an admin level account. So you should be able to go into settings, and let me share my screen on that again to do that. Well, actually, let me just settings. Okay, so here's my settings app in Windows 10. So I would go to accounts. And then what I would do is go into family and other user, and I would add a family member or add someone else to this PC. Now, the thing that, don't do it under family because that ties accounts together in weird and wonderful ways. So just go to add someone else to this PC. Now, right here, they say, how will this person sign in? They want an email address or a phone number. Choose, I don't have the only way you can create a local account, so it's not a Microsoft account. You have to click on this, I don't have this person's sign-in information. And then you go to add a user without a Microsoft account. And I highly recommend you do that so it's totally local to your computer. You don't have any dependency on being able to communicate with a Microsoft server at some point in time. And then you can just create it whatever you want. Weird Harold. And then you have to end in a password. And one of the things I really hate now is that I suppose it's good, but they force you into doing all of these questions, security questions. And I find it really, really annoying. But you do have to go through and choose one of them. You can put in nonsense answers if you want or whatever you want, but you end up, you have to put in these three security questions to create the account. Click on the next, and then it'll create that account. The other thing that's really important, well, actually, let me go through it, and I'll just do security question 2, and the answer Q, and childhood's nickname is Q, and then I can go in and I can say next. And then it creates it, but notice that it's not an administrator. So if you click on that, you can change the account type. And rather than standard user, I want it to be an administrator. Click on OK, and then it identifies it as an administrator account. So really important to have two accounts that you can log into that are administrator accounts. The last thing that is really important to do is actually log in once using that account, because that's what actually creates the profile. And the thing that you really start trying to guard against having a problem with only having one administrator account is if you have a corrupted profile, you can't log on to that computer as an administrator to fix it. And so by having another administrator account, it'll allow you to log in using that uncorrupted profile, and then you can either, you know, try and fix the other profile or delete it, recreate a new one, whatever you have to do, but you've got that two accounts. But it's really important that you log in at least once under that account in order for it to create the profile locally.
And the other thing that's important is to write down or stick in a password manager all that information about user ID and password and security questions. Because one of these days they might ask you.
Yeah, exactly.
Just a quick question here. If you're very lazy and you know you have computers that never leave your house or whatever, what are the issues between always running as an administrator and running as a user when you're just using it and only going to the administrator account when you need to do administration type stuff?
My personal opinion on that is that it's not a big deal as long as you don't do anything to defeat the elevation privileges, so the UAC prompts. Some people actually go and do that as well, so that if you try to do something that is potentially dangerous to your computer, you normally will get that prompt. It darkens the screen. You get the prompt saying that, you know, do you really want to allow this change or not? As long as you leave that in place, personally, I don't think that there's really a big danger in running as under an account that is an administrator on your computer. I always do. Best security practices say, yeah, you shouldn't do that. And then if you do get that prompt, you not only get the prompt, but you actually have to provide the credentials to an administrator account in order to create to do that particular function. I find that too much of an annoyance myself, so I don't bother. But if you really want to be secure, running under a standard user account is definitely going to be the preferred way of going about doing things. Very, very few people do. Anybody have another opinion on that?
Ever since Alan suggested having at least two accounts, I've always run as a standard.
Yeah. There's certainly nothing wrong with doing it other than the annoyance of having to provide credentials if you're trying to install software or something like that. But if you're willing to put up with that, for sure, it'll be a more secure environment.
It just stops me doing something stupid to myself.
That's true.
Partway, if I'm in the right account, of course.
Okay, do we have any other questions? We are just on the 8:30. So Eldon had, how do we create the two admin accounts? So I went through that, and I don't see any other questions that are in the chat window. So we'll have a going on for any other questions. Okay, so Alan threw up, if you have anything come up for next week, send it off to the suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we will definitely include it in the queue. And Alan and I will do our best to research ahead of time and see if we can come up with some answers. But, of course, we always encourage everybody to input to the process during Q&A as well. So I guess with that, I would like to thank everybody for attending. We had, I think, 25 people at one point on the call, so that's pretty good attendance for sure. We'll continue running these as long as people want to show up once a week. And thanks very much. The Q&A deck will be posted along with the audio file within a couple of days. So thanks much, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Everyone.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks.
So, Bob, you still on the line? Oh, he just disappeared. Okay. Alan, I sent Bob an email asking him to send you his deck, so you could then just include it in with the main deck, the slides that he had.
I've actually got slides.
Oh, you've got his. Okay. Okay. Sounds good.
So you'll send me the audio file when you have it?
Well, you've got the credentials for logging on to the Q&A account, eh?
Yeah, probably.
Okay, because I...
Do they do it automatically, or do we have to tell them to create the file?
No, it'll be created automatically. It'll take a couple of hours, I think, to... if you go now, it'll or as soon as I stop the session, if you go there, it'll say it's in preparation or whatever, and then it'll within a couple of hours, the file will be there. If you have a hard time finding it, just let me know.
Okay. And the same thing with the chat window. Does it save that automatically?
Yeah, it'll be in the one link that for the audio recording. I think it's one link that had both of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, folks. Bye.
Thanks. Bye now.